Let me ask you this. Is the world just getting worse and worse? Sometimes it seems that way if you even just take a couple of seconds and scroll through any of your news feeds and you take a look at the stories that are out there. Sometimes it can be overwhelming to see how much pain and suffering and evil can be in this world. And, you know, sometimes I think many of us feel that on a personal level. Maybe you've been through something really tough at some point in your life. Things just were so hard and something happened to you. Maybe somebody wronged you or maybe it was just part of life's circumstances. But you really felt like this is not the way that life should be. It's not the way that the world is supposed to operate. There's just too much pain, too much hurt, and I can't believe that this happens. Or maybe it is some of those global events. You know, you're going through your news feed, and we're just over and over reminded about climate change. We just ask, are we destroying our planet? Is there any hope for us as a species, or is this just going to continue, and this is the way that it is? We can look at wars that rage against different nations, and we're becoming more and more efficient at figuring out ways to exterminate one another. There are people, just huge groups of people that live in poverty, extreme poverty in many cases. And we might just look and think, man, this question, are things getting worse and worse? Do we have any hope in the world? Or is just this the way that things continue? And it is a bit of a religious question, but not just a religious question. I think pretty much everybody maybe asked this at some point in time, just wondering, what's the state of the world and of us? And how are we going to move forward? Do we have hope to move forward? Do we have hope that things are getting better? And we don't want to be naive about it. Some of us could be, because some of us, we've been born in a certain time and a place, into certain families, into certain socioeconomic status, where we might be tempted to say, oh, there's not really that much wrong with the world. You might go home today and say, man, I've got electricity and running water and access to great health care. I got a roof over my head and food on the table. What's really wrong? But again, we come to these points in our lives where we realize that there is great pain and suffering in our own lives, and we can't ignore the plight of so many people around the world as we look at that. At the same time, we don't want to become cynical, and we know that we have access, unprecedented access, to stories and information like nobody has in history. We can hear and read about all the terrible things going on all around the world instantly because of how connected we are. And so as we do read those things, sometimes we might feel like our hearts are becoming hard and we become hopeless as we just see all of these things and we hear about so much stuff. It can be hard for us to take in that much about the world, much of which isn't happening around us. And I don't think we're even designed to know all of these things and have the weight of the world's problems on us, but we do have access to that. And for some of us, that makes us sort of cynical. And I just wonder, as for those of us who are followers of Jesus, as we think through what he says about our world and what's going on in the world, how do we answer that question? Are things getting worse and worse? Or maybe in a more positive way, do we have hope for things to get better? And what is our part in it? I'll start by saying this. When it comes to the fact that there is evil in the world and there's so much pain and suffering, that is a very challenging question for anybody who believes in God, especially for people who believe in a God who is good and loving and also powerful. The challenge comes back, and the question is posed over and over like this. If God is so powerful and if God is so loving, why does he allow there to be so much pain and suffering in the world? Why does he allow it to be like this? Why did he allow it in the first place? And why doesn't he stop and do something about it? And for those of us who are Christians and we do believe in a loving God and a powerful God, we have to admit that that's a real hard question. And there are theologians and philosophers that write big, thick books. We try and weigh this way and that way and try and figure out how could this be. And I think there are some good answers that help point us in the right direction. I think one of the answers is that because God is a God of love, he gives us free will, because you can't force love. And love, if it's the ultimate ethic, the ultimate, that if God is love, he gives us that free will, but it also means we can reject him, we can turn, and we can do things that bring pain and suffering and evil into this world. And that might be a good place to start. But no matter what our answers are for that question, we have to acknowledge, man, it's really hard to reconcile the pain and suffering, the evil of this world, and a good, loving, and powerful God. Having said that, I also think that the problem of evil, pain, suffering in the world is maybe even more challenging to people who don't believe in a God. If you don't believe in a God and you don't believe in a loving God, then we might ask the question, well, why do we think there is something better? If we are simply here because of natural selection and there's no God guiding that process and there's no God that's setting a higher standard, then if we are here by natural selection solely, only, that's we're kind of a cosmic accident that are put here, then we have to acknowledge that that is a violent system of survival is the fittest. Survival of the fittest, those who exist, those who continue to live, are those who have won, and those who are weak die off, and violence is part of that. And if there is no God to set a higher standard, why would we wonder about that? Why would we even come up with the idea that there's something better? And perhaps you would say, well, because as we evolve as human beings, of course we come up with the idea that to live a life of love is better, and to be kind and not to exterminate each other is a better way to live. And you might be true, we can come to those conclusions, but what's to stop someone to coming to the other conclusion and saying, well, if this is why we're here, if this is how we got there, if this is what life is all about, then isn't it survival of the fittest? Why live an unselfish life if that's really all there is anyway? And then to wrestle with the question that if there is no God, what hope do we have? Can we have it in us as a species, as human beings, to create a better world, to overcome our challenges? And history might suggest that we certainly haven't figured that out yet. And so while evil and pain and suffering is a problem for those who believe in a God, I think it might be even more challenging for those who don't believe in a God, leaves us in a place of wondering, is there any hope? Can we move in the right direction? And how is that going to happen? I think many of us, regardless of your background, would acknowledge that we live in a tension. The tension goes this way. There's something wrong with our world. The world is not all as it should be. In some ways, it's amazing and great and wonderful, but we can't ignore the fact that there is this pain and suffering and something, the tension is that there is something better. We want something better. We're striving for something better. We want in some ways to be able to eliminate that evil, that pain, that suffering, and to live a different way. We're looking for it. I think we're longing for it. And what I think is that that points us to something that's greater than us, something outside of us. I think it points us to love, and I think it points us to love himself, the God that we see revealed in Jesus. And while it might be very difficult for us to explain, why did he allow in the first place for things to go wrong? And today we're going to look at this question even more in depth. Why does the world continue to look the way that it does? I think that even having that tension in our minds and our hearts, even that we've thought of that and we have that idea and we have that standard and we have that forward to and up to tells us that there is something more. And I think we call that God. Frederick Buchner observed that in every age, every generation, we have come up with fairy tales. There's something that just almost everybody throughout history, every culture and every generation writes fairy tales. And he says there's this idea that it's seemingly across all different cultures and time periods, we have this desire for something that is now unseen to manifest, the enchantment or re-enchantment of the world, that there's got to be something more to life than just what we can see and touch. And so you think of worlds that we create like Narnia. And these worlds that are now unseen always seem to be much closer than we could have ever imagined. In some ways, they seem so far apart. But think of the kids in the Narnia books. They go into this wardrobe and through the back of the wardrobe, and all of a sudden, right there, closer than they ever imagined, was a whole new world. Or somebody goes for a hike in the woods and they find a cottage and it's filled with dwarves and this whole enchanted life and what seemed foreign and different and weird all of a sudden is materializing right before their eyes. It's just right there, ready to be touched. And in a lot of ways, this is what Jesus taught when he said, "The kingdom of heaven is now at hand." This world that you long for, that in some ways seems so far away, is you're able to experience. It's right here. You could touch it. You could feel it. The windows, the curtains of heaven can be peeled back, and there's something more that you can experience in life. Except this is not a fairy tale. This is Jesus opening up our eyes to the deep truths of reality and of what God is doing in the world The kingdom of heaven is now at hand. That thing that you're hoping for, longing for, the re-enchantment of the world, the goodness breaking in to where there is evil, light coming into darkness, Jesus proclaiming, is now available to you. And he invites us to come and to see it and step into it and experience it, even in the midst of the world as it is and as we experience it. And that's what this series is all about. We're in part four. Don't tell me what to do. We're talking about some of the presuppositions we have, the way that we listen to certain voices and order our lives as a result, and to question some of those and to look at Jesus and to see what he teaches, a different way of living, different truths and presuppositions of how life is, and to being able to change our lives as we see that, to move in that direction. John Lennox, who's a professor of mathematics at Oxford and also a Christian apologist, writes a lot on some of these subjects of asking questions about why is there evil in the world and suffering and pain and how do we deal with it. And he puts it this way, talking about what we've just talked about. He says, granted that the world is filled with pain and suffering, is there any evidence that there's a God that could be trusted with it? In other words, if we said the problem of pain and suffering is universal, we all have to wrestle with it whether we believe there's a God or not. But if we just acknowledge that that's true, that that is true of our world, then what if we ask this question? Is there any evidence that there's a God that we could trust with all of it? If this world is a fallen place that has pain and suffering, is there anyone outside of it that we could give it to and actually trust that they could do something with it, that they could redeem it, restore it, make it what it's always meant to be? And that is what I want to talk about today. There's a story, a parable that Jesus talks about, and that's what he's getting at. It's in Matthew chapter 13. If you want to turn there and follow along, that would be amazing. Jesus has been teaching a number of parables, and he's teaching to big groups of people. And this is what it says in Matthew 13, verse 24. He put another parable before them, saying, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while his men were sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared also. And the servants of the master of the house came and said to him, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? How then does it have weeds? And he said to them, an enemy has done this. So the servants said to him, then do you want us to go and gather them? But he said, no, lest in gathering the weeds, you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at harvest time, I will tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them in the bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into my barn. So here we have a man, he sows good seeds to grow some wheat. And they find out along the way that also weeds grow up. The word here is a word, zizanian, which we would translate a couple of different ways into actually a specific kind of weed. We might call it darnel or tares. Some of your translations call this parable the parable of the wheat and the tares. Now, this is a specific weed that grows actually in places where wheat is the main crop. And what happens is, as the weed starts to grow, the tares start to grow as well. And the tares, as they grow, look almost identical to the wheat. So you can't even barely tell it apart. Eventually, the wheat grows up and the grain appears, the ear of the grain appears. And that's when you would notice all of a sudden that there's wheat, but there's also weeds. The weeds, the tares, don't get that part. And so up until that, as they grow, everything looks normal. They look the same. You look like you're just growing wheat until it's the time coming for harvest. And you see that the wheat has the grains, the ears of grains. And then you all of a sudden realize, wow, there's all of these weeds that are growing up. So you say, this is the problem. And the servants start looking around and they see this. And you got to just take in the story. If you're somebody who has a farm and this is your livelihood, this is how you provide for your family. And he's got servants. And so it's how they provide for their family. And it's all dependent on the crop. You grow the wheat, you harvest it, you sell it, everybody gets paid, everybody can provide for their family. And now they realize we have a great threat to our livelihood. What are we going to do? And the servants look and say, well, what happened? Didn't you plant good seeds? It's supposed to be all wheat, but now we see all these weeds. And the master looks and says, an enemy has done this. It's interesting. Sometimes we look at the things in the world. The first place we go to try and blame someone is we go to God. God, how could you allow this to happen? How could you keep the world the way that it is? Why aren't you doing something about it? And we have this statement that comes. We see the weeds. An enemy has done this. One has come in, planted this, and gone away. And so the servants come back. Well, then we've got to do something about it. Do you want us to go out and we'll start uprooting all of the weeds? And the master says, no. Well-intentioned, I get it. We got to do something. There's a threat here. This is all of our livelihoods. This is how we provide for our families. Somebody's come in and done this. We got to make it right. We got to figure it out. The field is too important and the weed is too important. But he says, not now. This isn't the time, because if you go in guns blazing, well-meaning, and you want to sort everything out, just realize that these things are growing so intricately that as you start pulling up the weeds, you're going to be pulling up wheat. Skip down a few verses. Jesus, he's spoken to this group of people, then he withdraws. And when he withdraws, his disciples come to him, and he's told a bunch of stories, a bunch of parables, and they come to him and they go, we want to know about that one. What's the deal with the weeds? Verse 36 says, then he left the crowds and he went to the house, and his disciples came to him saying, explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field. He answered, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. So Jesus, you told a lot of stories. We need to know what that one's about. And Jesus was good at this. He would tell stories and then he would just kind of walk away. And at the end of this teaching, he'll actually say, he who has ears, let him hear. The people who really want to understand these parables, they're going to go away and think about them and digest them and figure them out and come to it. That if you really want to understand, you got to pay attention. And so it's one of the reasons Jesus taught in parables. And instead of just telling people exactly what they should do or how they should think, he gives them a story to think about and to come to a conclusion. Now he's going to talk to his disciples and they say, man, we need you to interpret that for us. What was going on with the wheat and the weeds? Jesus starts by saying this, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. Now, these guys, they're all Jewish in the first century, and the Son of Man is a really important title. It's a power title. It's the title of the Messiah. It comes from Daniel chapter 7 in the Hebrew scriptures, and it is this, Daniel chapter 7, there's this heavenly vision. So it's kind of what we're talking about. If you peel back the curtain in what is often unseen in the heavenly realm, what is it that you see? And this is the description in Daniel chapter 7, starting verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, that's God, and he was presented before him. And to him, the Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So when Jesus says, hey, we have this story, and the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man, this is what they're thinking about. This is the Messiah. This is the one we've been waiting for, God's agent who's going to step in the world, and he's going to make things better. He's going to bring God's peace and his beauty and his grace, and he's going to put everything back together, and those who are suffering and hurting and in pain are going to be comforted and welcomed back, and everything's going to be made right, and everything's going to be made new. He is the Son of Man who's given power, glory, a kingdom, and everybody in all nations and all languages will serve him. His dominion, his kingdom is everlasting. It will never pass away. It will not be destroyed. He will win the day. The one who sows the seed, and remember, of course, the weeds come in, and everything's threatened, and everything looks like it could go wrong in the field. Hold on, just remember, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. It's a title Jesus uses for himself, and he's saying here, the Messiah is here, and I know you see that things are going wrong. I know you see that there's still pain. I know you're expecting it all to be made right, but just know, this is the Son of Man, and he has come, and he is sowing good seeds. The wheat is growing. Then he says, the field is the world, and the good seed is the sons of the kingdom. The weeds are the sons of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Well, if the Son of Man has come, why are there these weeds? How did this happen? Well, an enemy has come, the devil who comes to steal, kill, and destroy, the devil who is a liar, the enemy who has come, him who embodies all that is evil and bad and wrong, has come and started to grow up those who oppose what God is doing in the world. The field is the world. The field is everything around us. Look, there's wheat and there's weeds. And who should we say are the sons of the evil one? These are the ones who perpetuate injustice. These are the people who hurt other people, who reject God and all that he's doing that's good in the world. People who are in opposition to everything good that God wants to do for human flourishing in the relationship with him and in the relationship with other people. They inflict pain and suffering. People who would perhaps line their own pockets at the expense of those who live in poverty. Verse 40 says, just as the weeds are gathered and burned with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers, and throw them into the fiery furnace. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. He who has ears, let him hear. Now, when Jesus says this, if you read different commentaries and people who have written on this, there's two theories as to what Jesus is talking about in terms of the time period when this harvest takes place. One theory is he's talking about sort of the end of time, and what he's talking about here is heaven and hell. The other theory is that Jesus is talking about what's happening in his day and age. The people who would have heard this originally, when they hear about people who are lawless and sinful, again, these are first century Jewish men, they would have thought about their enemies, the Romans. See, these were people who were oppressed, they were hurting, some of them were being persecuted, they were under the thumb of foreign rulers, the Romans. And so when Jesus talks about this, whether he's talking about kind of that end time judgment or he's talking about the next 30, 40 years, which is when the Romans will come and destroy the Jewish temple, the Romans being the enemies and they'll oppress their people. And those are kind of the two different viewpoints. And people debate that. Is he talking about this is happening in the next generation, or he's talking about kind of end times, all of it. Either way, his closest followers would have been thinking the Romans. And so when we take that into the story, and he says, man, these servants, people like the disciples coming and saying, should we root out all the weeds? What he's saying is, I know what you're thinking, that the Messiah is here. Should we now go after the Romans? Should we pluck them out and remove them? One of the popular ways they thought they would do that in the first century Judaism was by fighting them, killing them. Do we revolt? Do we come up against them? I think what Jesus here is saying, listen, is if you pick this fight, you're going to have a fight. And maybe we're not called to fight the way that the rest of the world fights. Maybe there is a different way. And what you don't realize is you are not equipped to sort. See, the way that we think about the wheat and the weeds is we're always the wheat, and somebody else is always the weeds. We're a little biased, aren't we? Well, who's the good guys and the bad guys? Well, I'm the good guy, and even when I'm bad, I have good reasons for being bad, and oh, if you knew my circumstances and why I did this and how I was hurt and all the rest of it. We're never the bad guy. We're never going, I'm the weed that should be plucked out and thrown away. We have this bias, and I think what Jesus is saying to his followers is, I get it. You look at this and you go, the world's problem are the Romans. And we might substitute all sorts of different people, and these are the root of the world's problems, and these people and that people, and the people who did this to me and that to me, and this is why we're always the good guy, somebody else is always the bad guy. And here, part of how Jesus' story functions is that he looks out and go, listen, you might go in very well-intentioned to pluck out weeds and be ill-equipped to be able to tell the difference, and sometimes as they are intermingled, be pulling out wheat, the good. And that's not your job. Now, it doesn't mean we're passive against evil. It doesn't mean we don't fight against injustice. But we need to realize that it's not our job to fix the entire world. And we don't have a clear picture all the time. And we are not able to always separate just the bad and keep the good. But here's the rub of the story. There is one who can do that. The Son of Man. the one whose kingdom will last forever, the one who can ensure that everything that is good and beautiful for human flourishing, that is wonderful in God's eyes, will continue on into eternity. And he's the one that can make that happen in the long run. You are not in charge of the sorting. And now is not the time for you to sort. Again, I don't think he's saying, oh, don't worry about evil, don't push back against it, don't fight. He's saying, just be careful. If you think you're going to go out and say, these are the good guys and these are the bad guys, just know that you're not the ones called to sort. You know, this idea then, we got to tackle that the Son of Man has come, and we have this, like, you know, description that angels come and some are thrown into the fire. This is, you know, very farming, right? That which is weeds, that which is not useful, not helpful, not worth keeping is thrown and destroyed. It's kind of garbage. And this is often metaphoric language used for God's judgment. And there's a lot of different ways of looking at that as well. But let's say this, our culture, we talk about judgment, we look at that, and again, being reminded that we often are thinking of ourselves, I don't deserve to be judged, maybe somebody else does, but I don't. I'm always the good guy that has good intentions. But we push back against judgment. Our culture, we like our autonomy, we don't like to be told what to do, we don't often like the idea that Jesus could come in and be the sorter and figure out what's good and bad. That's something we like to take on ourselves. Understand this, especially in the context of the question we started with, which is there a God that we can trust with a world that seems to have a lot of evil in it? They were longing for judgment. Where we push back against it, they were longing for judgment. Why? Because these are people who are suffering. These are people who are victims of injustice. These are people who, it wasn't just a theory that, oh, the world can be a hard place sometimes. They're people who lost loved ones and were hurt and were right in the middle of being oppressed and pushed down and kept without. And so they look around and go, this world is a hard, evil place, and this can't continue. And if God is really loving and really powerful, he needs to do something about this. And then we come back and say, actually, that's the tension we struggle with too, isn't it? Well, if there's so much evil in the world, why isn't God doing something about it? And that's where we read about this, and Jesus assures them, God is going to do something about it. God is going to make sure that everything and all the causes, as we read there, of lawlessness and sin will be destroyed, will be taken care of. And those who embrace the goodness of God, the sons and daughters of the kingdom, will shine. That, you know, this idea that everything that is good and beautiful about humanity will live on forever, that God will preserve all that he possibly can that is good. Read what Peter says about this in 2 Peter chapter 3. Again, our sometimes hesitation is, do we really want God to judge us? Their culture would have said, what's taking God so long to judge those who are perpetrators of evil and injustice? And here's what Peter says in 2 Peter. But do not overlook this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is 1,000 years and 1,000 years as one day. The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. The question they were asking is, what's taking God so long? Why doesn't he just destroy everyone and everything that is not good? And Peter comes back and says, because God is being patient, because he wants everyone possible to have the opportunity to change their ways and embrace what God has for them and to embrace God himself. You know, just think about this. Think about on your worst day. Think about the thing that you regret most in your life, the time where maybe you hurt people the deepest, the thing that you wish you had never done. And could you imagine that at that moment, God stepped in and said, and I'm going to judge you based on this, and it's over. That's who you are and your identity, and forever that is going to ring into eternity. And Peter goes, here's what God does. He waits patiently, giving all the opportunity to change and to embrace what God has for them, because he's that loving and caring. And this was the answer for their question that Jesus was trying to address. Why do you let the weeds continue to grow? Is the world getting worse and worse, or better and better? Both. The weeds are growing, but the wheat is growing. And God doesn't want us to pull up all the wheat because we're just rooting out the weeds. Why is he patient? Why does he allow it to continue? I don't fully know the answer to that question, except that he wants all to be able to come to know him and experience his deep love and the eternal life that comes with it. And he is the one who who can see above all things and have the proper perspective to see people's hearts and to know the difference between wheat and weeds. And one day God will set all things right, and all the causes of lawlessness and sin, all that leads to death, all that's weeds will be done away with. But the wheat will shine in glory. In other words, God will undo all the damage that suffering has done. Oh God, why do you allow it all? I can't fully answer that question, but Jesus is trying to reinforce this idea that God will undo all the damage that suffering has done. And sometimes it seems like he's taking too long, and sometimes we struggle to trust that he will judge well, and Jesus is saying, we have a God that we can trust. You might say, how do we know? How do we know we can trust him to really judge? Based on two things, I think, that you don't find anywhere else in the world. The first is that God would not stay far off from the evil and suffering of the world. In Jesus Christ, we see the statement that God has stepped into a world of suffering and pain and accepted all of it on himself. In the cross of Jesus Christ, we see that God stands in our place. God stands in the pain and in the suffering. He takes on all the evil in the world. He sacrifices his life. He doesn't just say, this is a theoretical problem that we should write a book about and try and come up with answers. He enters into the suffering of the world. Is God loving enough to do something about evil and suffering and pain? Yes, he has stepped into it. If it's true, he has stepped into it and taken it upon himself. He has dealt with all that evil could throw at him on the cross. But is he powerful enough to do anything about it? And 3 days later, he was resurrected. He defeated death and the grave and conquered sin and all of its consequences. And that was a down payment. Him coming back to life, a down payment saying that those of you who die will come back and be raised in life also. Jesus is the first fruits, which means there are more fruit coming after him, that his life becomes our life. He is not only loving enough to step into pain, he's powerful enough to overcome its greatest effect, which is death, separation from God, absence of life. The Apostle Paul talks about his resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15, and he's talking about how Jesus was resurrected and how those who follow him, those who accept him, will be resurrected in a new life as well. And this is what he says about death, which is that ultimate enemy. He says, and then death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your victory? O death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. I love that. It says death is swallowed up in victory. What do you mean swallow? Why does he use that imagery of swallowing up death? When we swallow something, we eat food. We swallow it, means we take it inside of us. We digest it, and that food makes us bigger. It fuels us as we experience it and internalize it. And here I think the Apostle Paul hits on something amazing, that death, we don't just ignore it as a problem. We don't become cynical of death as the final ending, but instead, death is swallowed up. Suffering and sin and all that is bad and terrible and life-stealing is swallowed up, but that experience will make us greater. And in the resurrection and in the victory, all that was painful and all that was hurt and all that was wrong and all that was evil will be seen in a completely different life as we digest it and then live in victory. Live in a different reality, the life of God. This is the good news of Jesus. Can you imagine it? Imagine what that means. Think of some of the things that maybe pain you the most in life. Being swallowed up, not ignored, but swallowed up in victory. Think of maybe a relationship that is so broken in your life, somebody that there's so much hurt in your life that you would think, if there is a heaven, I don't even want them there. We're never going to be reconciled. And could you imagine walking into heaven and having all of that not forgotten, but reconciled and dealt with to the point where your relationship is back to where it was in the best possible way, and you see that person and look at them, you say, so glad that you're here. And think of how much greater that joy would be knowing where it once was, how bad it was. Imagine seeing people who had lived their whole lives in poverty and not having enough and scraping together and being hungry, one day walking in glory, and they have all that they need, and they're totally well-fed and well-clothed, and they know that they have a good provider, and their life has been restored to them. And imagine how much greater the joy knowing where they had come from. Imagine people that you've lost to death and the pain that you felt in losing a loved one and one day seeing them once more alive, death swallowed up in victory and the glory of restoration and the glory and the joy of God putting all things back together. Many of you know this. I've talked about it before. When I was 18, my dad passed away. He had fought through cancer and passed away. And it was one of those moments. And some of you have had those things happen in your life, something like that or something similar, something totally different, but just kind of a life-changing grief and pain. Time where you felt deep within your soul, this is not the way it's supposed to be. This is not how life is supposed to be. We're not supposed to lose someone this early. We're not supposed to go through this. We're not supposed to hurt this way. And I remember after he had died, sometime after, I had this dream. It was a really vivid dream that I've never forgotten. I've always remembered. It was just that vivid. And we're sitting at the dinner table, the family all around, after he had died, and we're celebrating something. Like it's Thanksgiving dinner, some kind of great family celebration. Everybody's there, and everybody's laughing and talking. And I look down the table, and there he is. He's there. And he's talking with people, and he's laughing. And in the dream, tears are streaming down my face. But they're tears of great joy because the one that we had lost and death being so final, and that's it, and it's never going to be a different way. But now here, restored, and here he is with us. All the joy of what seemed impossible made possible. It's Jesus saying, this is the plan. God is going to undo all the damage that suffering has done. You can bank on it. You can hope on it. The Son of Man, whose kingdom cannot be destroyed, is bringing life and light and everything that steals or takes away from that life, the life we have with God and each other, will be vanquished, will be defeated, and death itself will be swallowed up in victory. This is the good news of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, a God who loves us enough to step into our suffering, to endure it, and then to conquer it. The Son of Man, whose kingdom cannot be destroyed or taken away. God will undo all the damage that suffering has done. Heavenly Father, I pray that you give us the hope to believe it. I pray that you give us the eyes to see it when this world looks like it's struggling too much. When we feel it, not just in a theoretical sense, but deep in our souls, when we're hurt and when we're pained, when we're wronged, God, would you remind us that you are working all things together for the good of those that you love, and that one day the Son of Man in all his glory will put all things back together and everything that is for good and for life will endure into eternity. In Christ's name.